And welcome to the Rock and Roll Survivors Podcast, dedicated to those in front of the curtain, behind the curtain, and somewhere in between. So let's get started. When the truth is found to be Patty, you said something on the previous episode about your brother Michael, and I just had to clarify because I've been thinking about it ever since. And you and I have this joke about this phone book idea that you have of all your homeboys and guys that you played with, or the little black book that I, of course, want to hear more about, all the hookups that you had. But you mentioned that your brother had a book, or did I mishear that? And you said the title was The Unabridged, Uncensored, and Untidy Truth. And I'm just wondering, was this a real book that your brother wrote? Did he want to write a book with this title?
No, you know, his personality just freaks me out sometimes, because he could be the most abrasive and yet the most honest and tell the truth about himself. Whenever he talked to the press, that's how he talked, you know, the real truth of how it came out. And he would tell the real stories. And I just thought that was an amazing dichotomy of his personality for somebody having, you know, a healthy ego and very confident. And yet he could turn the corner and say, oh man, did I screw up? And he never had a problem doing that to the press. So that's what I meant, you know.
I love that. And I mean this with love, because I think the world of your brother, everything about him, I just think he's the best. But your brother really is the walking embodiment, if you looked it up, of the expression TMI, too much information.
Yes.
He is uncensored all the time. And my favorite thing about him is he almost feels like there's a personal affront if you get offended by something he said. He's like, well, you asked, you're here listening. It's on you.
That's true. It's so true.
Well, the other thing that I want to pick up on was on the last episode, we were singing Leo Fenn's praises. That's your band's manager now, about his aptitude for being an incredible manager, pretty much right out of the gate. And this is without any prior firsthand experience. It's not like he had trained under somebody prior. He was handpicked by your father to be the band's manager, married to Arlene. But I'd like you to say a little bit more about Leo Fenn's innate and natural talents, clearly.
What would you choose? Working in a car factory or working in showbiz? I mean, think about it. And he was married to a showbiz family. So I think that he innately picked up on a lot of stuff, at the dinner tables and watching Mike and Dad. So he was a quick study and it was very smart of Dad. There you go, Arthur Svengali. You come in here and do this, be the manager. It's hilarious how it rolled out. And Leo just took to it so quick, so quick.
You just said something, of course, as you always do, so brilliant. But you're right, because Arlene and Leo met in high school. They were high school sweethearts for the most part. So he would have seen your brother and your father and all of you in showbiz. And even before Arlene was in the Pleasure Seekers, he was seeing all of this.
Absolutely. He was geared up and ready for it, and he just picked it right up. It's amazing how quick he picked it up. And he was good at it.
He was good at it, but also that is funny to think about. Yeah, which one would you pick? Car industry or
Exactly. Oh my God. No
I don't
kidding.
need to think about it. I already know. Well, something else that you said about Leo's instincts for managing is that, and I wanted to talk about this because a reminder that the pleasure seekers, except for Arlene, I believe, you're all still teenagers. And Leo flew prior to spring break for school because Susie and Darlene are still in high school. And so he went ahead of time to meet with Joe Glazier, to get Joe Glazier at ABC Booking interested, to talk about the band's future. And so I just want you to expand upon this idea that he had, because it never even dawned on me until you said it, that of course the itinerary for a underage band, that would have to be taken in school time, summer breaks, whatever. So I'd like to hear more about this.
That's the only time we could really expand and do something different. And Leo realized that as we started in. Dar and Susie had to obtain fake ID from a young man in Detroit whose family was in the mob there. My little phony ID didn't work anymore. I mean, it had to be pretty darn professional. So it was $50 per ID. So we could play clubs and get out of Michigan and all that. Darlene had to get permission to miss school. I don't think her school vacation was exactly the same as Susie's, but she got permission. And so we were able to do that Easter thing. It was so damn important. It changed everything.
Oh, wow. Well, first of all, $50 for a fake ID was a lot of money back then. I hope it
It was good. It
was
worked.
good. And that's right, because Darlene was not in Grosse Pointe. She was outside. So she would have been at a different school.
Different school.
Wow. Well, another question that I have for you, and you've mentioned it, or maybe you've mentioned it to me privately, but so Leo is now the band's first manager officially. Prior, you were the band leader. You pretty much, air quotes, managed everything beautifully, by the way. But I'm curious because I really want you to tease this out. Did Leo make any definitive, permanent, or strict rules or regulations when he first came on as your manager? And how did that work out then being the husband to Arlene, one of the band members? But I'm curious, did he have a model that he came in with and said, this is how I see the band, this is the branding, the personas of all of you? I'm curious.
I think all the parents appreciated where our heads were at that moment in time. We were not girls that were doing the sex, drugs, and rock and roll scene and wanting to party after the gigs. We were tired. We did our thing. We went home to bed. We maybe had to travel the next day. Leo did indeed develop a mystique around the pleasure seekers. He really did, because he made sure we told the line and took care of ourselves health-wise, which is what the parents wanted, and that we would be safe. So, being the man, he did all that. And he did build a mystique as time went on, because we weren't known as girls that were going to run out and party with the other bands. So it sort of rolled in organically, just started happening. But we cared more about the music and what we were doing and doing credit to it while we were doing all these gigs.
Was there ever, I'm just curious about this as husband and wife, did Leo ever have an issue with how hot, sexy, and gorgeous Arlene was? And more, or equally as important, the response from the male fans, whether on stage or off stage or dressing rooms? I'm curious.
To be really honest about this, because we had Arlene's own words on one of the episodes, I think that it really got her analyzing, sort of analyzing her marriage, because as time went on later, it did become an issue, not with the attention, but her feeling she might have missed something marrying so early. But in the early stages, no, he was proud of her. It was like, I've got her. I mean, he recognized how hot she was and how good she did on stage. That only came in later as she started evolving and wondering about her own marriage, which was sad, but there was a lot of good years there where he was very proud of everything she did on stage. Very proud. So no, it didn't. I don't think it bothered him. I mean, these fans weren't overt where they were like trying to pick her up and all that. They were just in the front row, gaga eyes, that kind of thing. So he could handle it. He's a big boy,
He's a big boy and he's a proud husband at that point.
Yes, exactly.
Well, the other thing that you mentioned about Leo in the previous episode was that when he went to NYC before your spring break, he met with the higher ups at ABC Booking, which I mentioned, and Joe Glazer was interested enough in Leo's pitch to want to see the Pleasure Seekers live, which is how, and so I want you to tell now the chronology. Is this how the ball starts to get rolling? It's Joe Glazer. Tell us a little bit who you mentioned briefly last time who Joe Glazer is, but was he now his interest the reason why you said we're going to New York?
Yeah, let me flesh this out a bit, because there's a whole scene transition happening. We're now in the burgeoning up and in full bloom hippie movement, free love, the whole thing. There were not only teen clubs anymore, okay, that were happening through the country. It was also the mixed era of entrepreneurs that wanted to get involved in music. They were being drawn to the rock music industry. So you had a mix of teen clubs, adult clubs, even disco clubs, and rock ballrooms starting and festivals starting. They were coming into play in competition with the wanting to book all these cool rock bands. And the bands wanted to move up the food chain and get their music out there to a larger audience. So having a top national booking agency became very important at this moment in time. And ABC was at the top of that food chain. And I'm pretty sure that on his meeting with Joe, which Mickey probably helped get, that he wanted to see us live. He was very interested. And we were gobsmacked that Leo and Mickey were able to arrange that so quickly. And we knew the reputation because, they filled us in what he was trying to get us as he went to New York. And oh, it was amazing. It was amazing.
Well, I just want to interrupt for one second, only because I want to remind all of us, but really I'm saying this more for me, thinking about this pitch that Leo gave to Joe Glazer at ABC. This is not where he could put together what we would now call a sizzle reel of the band and some live footage, right? He had one single with two songs from The Hideout that
Right.
he was able to play. I mean, there were photographs, of course, there were some press clippings. But that's a serious pitch. So I just wanted to put that out there that, yeah, Leo Fenn certainly had his chops early on.
And think about it. Joe was so interested. He was no fool, a hot girl band. How cool, how cool was that? And he called Trudy immediately.
Okay, Trudy
He
Heller.
Trudy Heller, and he got us booked in there. I mean, this is instantaneous. He got a booking right away because Easter was coming right up.
Okay,
And
wait. So, because hold on, Patty, I guess, remember, this is now 1967, and this is about to be spring break in March. But I really, for those who don't know, and I want to hear it from you, please tell us who Trudy Heller was, because she was pivotal. She was really pivotal in the music scene, as was Joe Glazer. I mean, in different genres. But tell us who Trudy Heller was.
Oh, she was amazing. Heller, Trudy Heller's club was where the glitterati rocked the night away. New York City, Greenwich Village, 6th Avenue and 9th Street, a swinging discotheque. And it was a true early precursor to Studio 54 in every single way you can imagine. Go-go dancers lined the walls. Let's mention some of the rock legends and people, glitterati, that hung out at this club. Linda Bird Johnson, George Hamilton, Salvador Dali with his pet ocelot, the Allman Brothers, Cyndi Lauper, Peter Criss of Kiss, Otis Redding, Sam the Sham, on and on and on. Rock star studded hotspot, known as the top place to be. The lines were outside every night, and it was not a big club either. We were jammed in there. It was amazing.
Wow. Well, one of our diehard listeners and a dear friend, John Gill of the band Big Stick, he and his partner Yana Trance, they had a huge cult following in the 80s. They too performed at Trudy Heller's. And John was saying to me that that was kind of at the tail end of the icon status of Trudy Heller's, but that it was the place in the 60s and the 70s. So the fact that you can add to the glitterati list. Now, the pleasure seekers, here is this moment where, and you're going into Trudy Heller's knowing the status of this club,
Oh,
correct?
yeah. Yeah, definitely. We knew. Oh, my God. And it's funny because we didn't prepare in any way. We had our sets worked up, okay? And Trudy's, you had to do a lot of sets, but you could repeat a couple. But anyway, we had our set. We were confident about that. So we were just anxious to get there. We were so excited.
Well,
And
I
we
want to
did.
talk. Hold on. I want to talk about you getting there, but I guess just a technical detail question.
Yeah.
So, I mean, for those who maybe didn't grow up in the biz, whether in LA, Detroit, or New York, is all it took Joe Glazer picks up the phone to Trudy and says, "You need to book the Pleasure Seekers so that I can see them live"?
Yes, he was feared. He was the top gun. He was so important at that era in time. And we did a few gigs beforehand. We did an Autorama and we played that Hideout gig with Scott Richard. I mean, and then we were getting ready, doing our best costuming and everything. And a funny thing happened right before we left after that gig with Scott. Oh,
Yes.
you're not going to believe this
Oh,
one.
wait. That you're talking about your birthday, March 10th, 1967,
Yes. Oh my God.
and a gig at the Hideout with SRC and Scott
Yes.
Richardson. So go on.
So the next night, my parents took me to this jazzy place, big nightclub thing, and Liberace was playing. Okay. And this rocker, this one right here, he pulled me on the stage to dance with him. How many rockers do you say that can say they danced with Liberace? I mean, it cracks me up, but that's
Patty,
what happened.
you know what? You are a rock and roll survivor now on a whole new
Oh,
level.
yeah, whole different level.
That's hilarious. So you're putting together your set list, you're doing these local gigs, which we've heard about. But some of the things that I want to also talk about was, okay, some logistics. Who was going to fund getting the Pleasure Seekers and Leo to New York to play at Trudy Heller's? I mean, just whose dime was this on?
I'm sure there was some kind of a deposit by Trudy or something. And it's possible that my dad fronted a little bit of, we drove cars, so that saved money. We didn't fly, and we had our U-Haul and all that. So I think it just happened where we were able to get there and book the hotel, and we stayed at the famous Gorham Music Hotel, and it all just came together. But we drove. We drove.
I was wondering if you flew or if you drove. So at this point, Arlene and Leo also happen to have three very young children. So, did those kids go with you? Did they stay with your mom and dad? How did this work out?
I hope I'm right about this. We would probably have to ask Arlene again, but I don't think the kids came on that trip. They did start coming for a while with a nanny, Mrs. Sweet, and then it just got too hard, and my parents sort of took over and they left the kids at home with my parents. But I don't think they came on this trip. It was too much going on with, entering the New York City and this big hot spot. It would have been really hard. So I think I'm right. We'll have to check with Arlene.
We'll definitely check with Arlene, but that makes sense to me. I mean, I just think the anticipation, the excitement,
Yes.
everything that was
Yeah.
happening, it was all new. And so, speaking of that, I want you to set the stage for us, as I like to say, in terms of what were you feeling? I mean, don't think, of course you can reflect back now, but I mean, this is really exciting. And I want to remind everybody that, Patty, in 1964, at the ripe age of 16, you had an epiphany of wanting to start an all-female rock and roll band while seeing the Beatles live at Olympia in Detroit. And now, 3 years, almost a little less than 3 years later, you are heading to New York City with major showbiz interest, going to play at Trudy Heller's with the interest of Joe Glazer at ABC Booking. And I mean, epiphanies are one thing to have. I've had 400 of them. I've never had it manifest the way your epiphany did. So I just want to hear what it was like for you personally, if you have any memories of the band getting ready for this, stories and excitement, anything.
The one thing we did that was amazing, and we were known for this, we concocted a Motown review, okay, and where we traded instruments all the way around, like different singer, different person playing an instrument, and we just, it all flowed, and it was an amazing set. We got that ready for sure. And you know what? I remember intense realization of what an opportunity this was going to be to break the band out in a national way. Of course, we were excited. And I'm sure we were probably nervous the first night, but most of the time, our attitude took over. It's like, we're going to show them what girls can do, you know? So I'm sure that was in there because it's always in the pleasure seeker's attitude. And it was just an amazing time. We were excited, and being able to maybe sign with Joe Glazer, the top booking agency, that, and playing the hottest spot in New York City. Oh my God. I
Well,
mean, what more could you ask for leaving Michigan, you know?
it really is just this incredible musical fairy tale. But I do want to pick up on Joe Glazer, because you said before, when he picked up Trudy to call Trudy Heller, he was a heavy hitter. And you said there were some stories about him and his influence in the music biz in New York. And Patty, you and I talked a lot about this, or I shouldn't say a lot, enough though, in season two, about what went on in the music scene in Detroit. And the mob in Detroit and the music scene is, I mean, inextricably linked. And so I want you to talk a little bit about some stories of Joe Glazer that you have, even though he's in the booking agency biz and he's a heavy hitter. I want you to talk a little bit about, because these stories are fascinating.
Well, the whole education of music, the mob, and New York City environment was all obviously so new to us. And we learned as we went. And I've said before in other episodes, I learned more on the road than I would have learned in college. It's a worldly education. So we learned a ton. And I had left college. And it's quite important to flesh out Joe. He was the president of Associated Booking Corporation, called ABC, was the top national music booking agency at this time. He was a feared person in the music industry, and he had come from handling fighters and managing clubs and acts. He managed Louis Armstrong, and together they started the agency, also with help of alleged mob connections. Okay. To make a historical point, at this era, the mob was quite enamored and involved in music business. I mean, you think about it, everyone knows that they were in with Frank Sinatra's career, I mean, it was like a common duality back then, mob and music. And Joe represented, get this, Duke Ellington, Benny Goodman, Lionel Hampton, Woody Herman, Dave Brubeck, Barbra Streisand, B.B. King, the Allman Brothers, T-Rex, and so many more, so many. But
Wow.
as I said before, he only handled personally Louis Armstrong, Billie Holiday, and wait for it, the Pleasure Seekers. He
Oh.
took us on personally, and he always took Leo's call. Leo was in direct contact. So Leo must have impressed him to some degree that he knew what he was doing, because Joe was a direct relationship with Leo. It was amazing.
Well, I
And
think also that Joe was incredibly impressed with you, the pleasure seekers, to want to take you on personally. I
oh,
mean,
he had big plans. He had big plans for us directly. I mean, he told Leo that because he liked the look of it, the feel of it, the whole thing, and it was something unusual. A bit of interesting trivia too that I'll stick in. From
please.
his Chicago days, he knew and dealt with Jack Ruby, who was called Sparky, the guy that killed Lee Harvey Oswald. And they were involved with each other in the Chicago days. And he had an FBI file. Joe Glazer did. And he had to quickly disinvolve himself. You know, as he started getting bigger and bigger and bigger, he said, oh, Ruby was a mental case, a phony, a name dropper. And he exaggerated our personal relationship. But he was doing fighting stuff with him as late as 1966, but he quickly drew away. So that was a
Wow.
fun Joe and his FBI file.
Please, somebody do a Netflix series on that whole story because I want to binge watch it. That is fantastic.
It's so
So
fun.
we're gearing up now. The pleasure seekers are hitting the Big Apple. You're on the road, so we know you're not flying in your pleasure seekers van and paint, pink letters, black and pink letters. You have the U-Haul, as you said. You have now you're dealing with the mob in the music industry, now not just Detroit, but now in New York as well. You have the continuing momentum of the band on the road. And also, you know me, I'm so excited when you get to New York. I can't wait to hear more about the happenings, the hangouts, the hookups, the hot spots, and all the hijinks in the hotel room. So,
Oh
the Big
my God.
Apple is calling to the pleasure seekers.
Oh my God, is it calling? We were definitely thrown into a more adult world. And yet Leo took good care of us, even with the influence of what we knew about the mob and music and all that. And oh, the stories will abound, and you have no idea all that came to pass from that trip and more. Five girls on the road. I mean, you just can't imagine all the unusual, dramatic, humorous, all kinds of events coming up.